Humanity in healthcare is seeing and being seen, and hearing and being heard, and healing and being healed.
More human healthcare means I know what matters to my patients, not just what's the matter with them.
And more human healthcare means extending kindness, compassion and fair treatment, regardless of my faith, nationality and race. Remembering that underneath it all, we're all human.
More human healthcare means remembering everyone involved is human.
As staff, it would mean the umbrella of safety and compassion is extended to me. As a patient, it would mean not to be unfavorably cared for because of who I am.
More human healthcare means a warm and listening face, an attitude of respect, and an honest and open response.
Humanized healthcare for me is more than just dressing my wounds. It's holding my hand, looking into my eyes, asking how I feel. It's checking that I'm not scared, treating me like a human being.
Welcome to the Point of Care Foundation podcast. I'm Bev Fitzsimons, Chief Executive of the Foundation. In each episode, we'll be looking at what humanising healthcare looks like in practice. Making healthcare more human, both for the people working to deliver care and for the people they care for, is the mission of the Point of Care Foundation. And to do that, in our winter series of this podcast, we want to share some of the reality of working in healthcare from different perspectives across the NHS and social care. These voices from the point of care are an important counterbalance to some of the rhetoric that's flying around the press, with healthcare staff represented as heroes and sometimes villains, and when in reality we're all just humans who have good and bad days. We think it's important to share some of the joy of the work of health and care, whether they're the colleagues, the moving tributes, or simply the patients and the impact you have on their lives. But it's also important to understand some of the realities of working in healthcare and the toll it takes, as well as the great bits that really get you up in the morning. So I'm joined today by Lisa Cooper, who is the Director of Community and Mental Health Services at Alder Hey Children's Hospital in Liverpool. She's a senior leader in the trust and sits as part of the executive board. In her Twitter profile, she describes herself as a dietitian by background, but one that still eats chocolate. So welcome, Lisa.
Thanks, Beth. And I eat chocolate most days.
So, Lisa, could you start by telling me a little bit about your role at Alder Hey and what a typical day or a week is like, if there is such a thing?
So I've been at Alder Hey just over 3 years, and as you introduced me very kindly, and my big title is the Director of Community and Mental Health Services. So that means I'm responsible for pretty much all of the services that happen outside of the acute hospital site. So for me, my services are the physiotherapy, dietetics, speech and language therapy services in the community, community paediatrics, and then all of the mental health services that happen outside of the hospital. So if it's in Sefton or Liverpool, if it's in a child's house or a community clinic or in a youth centre somewhere, and it's a health service for children, young people, then it's invariably one of my services. And it's a real privilege of a job, if I'm honest. And it was my dream job when it was advertised. So when I saw it advertised, it was the job that I never thought I would get the opportunity to do or have. But it is a real privilege. So yeah, anything outside the four walls of the acute hospital is mine.
So Lisa, what does a typical day or a week look like for you then?
And in terms of a typical day or week, well, I was thinking about this because you always like to think, oh, there's nothing typical about it. But actually, when you look in your diary, and we're governed by diaries, aren't we, nowadays in the NHS, and particularly as senior managers, there are set points throughout the week where I have certain meetings. So part of my job as the director, unfortunately, I probably spend far too much time in meetings, and now these are virtual. that's a bit easier, but certainly meetings around the trust board and the executive group and the safety and quality committees. And then in between that, it's about meeting with the various heads of service about the running of their services on a day-to-day basis. But also a big part of my job is working with external stakeholders around children and young people's services across Liverpool and Sefton. So I spend quite a lot of time working with local authorities, with education, with children's social care, with other providers of health services. So if we take our mental health services, we work with a huge number of third sector organisations who have a really valuable role to play in providing services for children and young people. So a lot of my week is working with those as well, providers, around how we can continue to improve services.
Do you ever get a chance to see what it's like on the front line?
At least once a week, I try to spend some face-to-face time with one of my services, because I, as you said in the introduction, I am a dietitian. I'm still registered. And the bit I miss the most about this job is not seeing children, young people every day clinically. So a highlight for me is that I go to spend some time with my frontline staff. And that's twofold. So first and foremost, it's the highlight of my week, because it makes me realise why I do this job and the difference I can make to children and young people doing this job. But also it's a real opportunity to touch base with frontline staff to understand what's happening to them on a day-to-day basis, but also what are the things that annoy them, what can be changed. Because when I was a frontline staff, some of the best people who spent time with me were like the directors and stuff, and that's how I moved things on when I was a frontline member of staff. So that's a sort of typical week. Obviously, it's Monday when we're doing this interview, so already I've had three meetings that I hadn't planned for about three things I wasn't thinking about, but a lot of it's fairly typical. I'd say 80% typical work, 20% unpredictable, apart from when you go into a global pandemic and then it's the other way around, she says.
Thanks, Lisa. I'm interested in the perspective of senior leaders in the NHS. What's it like to be in the really senior position in an NHS trust just now? What are the particular pressures of that sort of senior role?
Yeah, I think, well, for me, it's a privilege to do the job and to be a senior leader and to be a director. But now, and particularly after the last 18 months, the things that worry me are about staff morale and well-being. I don't think, you know, I've got nearly a 30-year career in the NHS, and I don't think I've ever known it as hard as it has been over the last 18 months. I think staff have given their all, and I think they're tired. And I think that includes us as senior leaders. I think sometimes we have to be brave and say, you know, we're tired, we're exhausted. And I know for myself, with my staff, we've continued throughout the year doing divisional development days and just trying to have a bit of fun, whether that's virtually or our next one is face to face. And I just like to organise, you know, like a quiz or bingo or a cup of coffee and biscuits. And I say it can't all be about it this time, about what services are we delivering? How are we going to continue to, you know, do this? Or what are we going to develop? Sometimes the real important bit at this moment in time is us getting together and having that human connection and knowing that we're human beings.
But inevitably, people have good days and bad days. How do you deal with the it's okay not to be okay moments?
We've really encouraged, and as the director, I've really encouraged my senior leadership team to show that vulnerability, and myself included. So I've been very honest with staff and said, you know, today is not a great day for me. I'm really sorry that today I have shown up probably a bit short-tempered. I've probably definitely been irritable. I've looked tired and I've felt tired. Tomorrow's going to be a new day. I'm going to take a bit of self-care time tonight, and I'm going to do, you know, look after me, because it is never ending. And it has been, you know, particularly the previous 12 months, you know, in that whole pandemic phase, it felt like we were all working 24/7. And my job traditionally is and I say this tongue in cheek, Bev, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. As anything can be. Obviously, it's not 9 to 5, but it wasn't always working evenings and weekends. And I think we've all ended up doing that. So it's really taken its toll.
So it must be quite frustrating at times then when the service is suffering from ill-informed criticism.
I think I'm so as well as being tired and exhausted like everyone else, I'm really frustrated as the senior leader in the NHS at the moment. If I'm really honest, I think I really struggle with nationally the picture that's being portrayed around the NHS. And unfortunately, I'm very cynical. So my husband always says to me, when everyone was clapping and we were out clapping on a Thursday night, I did say at one point, it won't be long before we're blamed for everything being wrong. And unfortunately, I see that coming true in the media. And I get really angry about that, because I get really angry because the NHS is a massive employer of people in this country. In fact, I think it might be the largest employer, or certainly not far off. And so actually when media and politicians, and I'm not getting political, portray the NHS as X, Y and Z, it's a huge detrimental impact on staff morale. And people work in the NHS, it is still a vocation. It is still to work and survive in the National Health Service. You have to be committed and dedicated. If it was about being paid millions of pounds and having X amount of holiday and doing lots of brilliant and amazing things, then the NHS wouldn't necessarily be the place people would choose to live. I joined the NHS because I come from a long family history of people who work in the NHS, of strong women who've worked in the NHS. So both myself and my sister work in the NHS, and my mum and my grandmother before her. And I just wanted to make a difference. And that's still what I want to do, is make a difference.
We touched on the well-being and the morale of staff, and I know it's a big priority for the leadership team at Alderhay to make sure there are things in place to look after staff well-being. How do you get to de-stress and decompress as a senior leader? Where does that kind of support come from for people like you in the leadership role?
So I said I eat a lot of chocolate, so I definitely ate a lot more in the last 18 months than I should have done. Internally, I have a really good support network with my senior team, so my divisional chief nurse and my divisional chief operating officer. So we have a really good relationship. And at the very start of COVID, I put in at the end of every day that we need to catch up for half an hour. And we do that half an hour. We do 15 minutes of what's gone good today, what's gone bad, what do we need to know? So we're connecting with each other because we aren't all in at the same time anymore. And we used to be. So those, corridor conversations over a cup of coffee, you miss that with everybody. And then the last 15 minutes are, what are we watching on TV? What are we doing over weekend? You know, Christmas shopping, you know, so something not related to work and to decompress. I think, as I said, we role model being very open and honest with staff. So those conversations, I've got good relationships with some of my exec colleagues. So we'll say, should we have a virtual coffee and just talk about sometimes something other than work? Because you need to remember you've got a life outside of work. That's been really difficult for everybody in the last 18 months, because particularly in the beginning, as I said, we all ended up working almost 24/7, and the virtual world perpetuated that. I could do my emails of an evening, and I could do a call, and I could do that. And I needed to remember, outside of work, I have a life and a family who don't work in the NHS. One of the big things I do is I've got a dog, Bev, and there isn't nothing that Spike the Beagle doesn't know about how the NHS should be run and is currently running. So out for a walk for a good 2 hours, first thing in the morning, and then before I go to work, and then definitely last thing at night, even in the rain and hail. There's nothing quite walking a dog in the pouring rain to make you forget everything that you've done in work. But it is that self-care bit. And I think getting back in touch with friends over the last couple of months has been the best thing for me and for my mental health. Still feels a little bit like we're in limbo, but it's really important. So definitely in work, the importance of a senior team. And I suppose, you know, laughing at stuff, really, whether that's quite a dark sense of humour as well. Sometimes in the NHS, people can have quite dark senses of humour. But yeah, I'm remembering we're human. And like we said, saying, you know what, today is a bad day. And then people are really, a cup of coffee and the biscuit, you know, that type of thing.
What's the best thing about working at Alder Hey and the things that give you real joy in your job? What gets you jumping out of bed in the morning apart from Spike?
So the best thing about working in Alder Hey, I said, didn't I, it was my dream job and is my dream job. So I get to go to work every day to an organisation that puts children and young people at the heart of everything it does. So for me, that's my real passion, is children and young people, and particularly the voice views of children and young people and how we use that to drive through improvements in healthcare and the services we do. So the best bit is it's a children and young people's organisation, and it does lots of really exciting things for children and young people. So the holiday season is coming up, so we're getting into Christmas planning, and Christmas is a massive thing at Alder Hey, and I love Christmas. And whilst a lot of it's virtual now, it's those types of exciting things.
What else goes on during the year?
One of the best things, Bev, is every now and again, the football clubs come to visit, and I'm a massive Liverpool supporter. So I've met the Liverpool mascot and I've touched the Liverpool trophies. So little things like that are really nice. And they're the perks of the job we get. We've got a brilliant charity that supports. So I've never worked anywhere where I've been able to do the really extra special stuff for children and young people. So that's great.
What about community and mental health? That was your original calling, if you like.
I'm a community and mental health practitioner through and through. Other than initially when I qualified and worked in acute settings, I've always worked in community mental health settings. So I always say to people, it's where real life happens. It is seeing children, young people and their families at home, in schools, in their communities. And that plays into all of my personal value set about social responsibility and community work. And I've seen, you know, in my clinical career, but also in this job, firsthand the difference my services and staff make to children. So it's great that the hospital does lots of sexy, whizzy stuff. But what we do in my division, in my services, is ensure that children, young people get to live the life they want to live at home with their family and friends. And sometimes it's a small change that has a massive impact. So that's the thing that gets me really excited and to talk about. And then the one thing that gets me to jump out of bed, if I do jump out of bed, is if I'm spending any time with children and young people's groups, so the Alder Hey Youth Forum or our mental health groups. So when I came to Alder Hey, relaunched the Alder Hey Youth Forum because we didn't have an active forum and we didn't really highlight the need for social action by children and young people and that connection with our local community. So the universe and the NHS is in safe hands because young people are brilliant and amazing. So when I feel a bit like, oh, what will happen and what's going to happen to the NHS and all of that, I meet with young people and I realise, you know what, it's going to be even better than it is now because they're going to carry on with the mantle and the torch.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I've got a 17-year-old and him and all his friends are so brilliant. You know, I just think they're cracking young people today, aren't they?
And it lights the passion in you from when you were a young person. So whether you get a glimmer in this podcast, but I was a young person that protested against everything and demanded action and had dreadlocks, Bev, and I tied myself to a digger to stop roads, toads not roads, and did all of the things that as a young person you're meant to do, that when you get older you do it, but you do it in a slightly different way. I would probably still tie myself to a digger, but I certainly wouldn't sleep out overnight, which I would have done in my 20s, you know. But when I meet with them, and my nieces and nephews the same, they're so enthusiastic. You know, the climate change and the things that they're worried about are absolutely the right things. And it breathes that life back into you, doesn't it? You know,
definitely, definitely. So what about the difficult stuff, Lisa? What are the really difficult things, what aspects of your role or the things that happen at work that trouble you the most?
Yeah, so the things that keep me awake at night are waiting lists for children, young people waiting to access services, and particularly the demand for services. And in particular reference to that, our mental health services, I probably should have mentioned it earlier, but it particularly keeps me awake at night and worrying is the amount of children and young people in the last 18 months who now need to access very specialist mental health services. The age of these children and young people is so much younger. Their profile is that they are so much more poorly, will need even more support. And I worry about them and how they're going to grow up to be happy and healthy adults. Not in terms of, you know, the waits for services are astronomical, but we are doing our best recruiting staff and changing services. But just how the last 18 months is really seeing that. It's that mark on children, young people's lives. And, you know, my experience tells me from other jobs that we're not even at the top of the curve for demand. And also, we won't really know the impact for many, many years to come, particularly for children and young people who've perhaps been exposed to abusive situations, whatever that may be, or been placed in abusive situations in the last 18 months, that we may not know the impact of that until they're well into their adulthood. And that, if I'm honest, makes me very emotional and breaks my heart a little bit, because without that pandemic, there are whole groups of children and young people who wouldn't need to access health services in the way that they do now, because if the pandemic hadn't happened, then they wouldn't have needed it. And I haven't got any research and lots of evidence, and loads will come out about that, but years of experience and just seeing how children are presenting. And I think it's that really upsets me. And I think as well, what's really difficult is that the profile of children and young people and that impact is not there still nationally, and we'll come on to that later.
Do you think that the period when children weren't able to be in school has had a particular impact?
You know, children and young people not being in education for the best part of 12 months is a significant impact. And because we work in community mental health services, and as the director, you know, one of our objectives in the health service and in my division is to make sure children are ready for school and go to school, because the importance of an education is just as important as access to their healthcare. Because actually, if they're in education, they often don't need healthcare, but also a lot of supportive mechanisms in education support them to manage their healthcare as well, and they go hand in hand. So I think that, and them not having a voice. And because we were fortunate, weren't we, that COVID as a clinical condition didn't impact children clinically as that result. The bit I get really angry about is, but it did impact on them in other ways, and we forget that. So that's really difficult. It's really difficult to maintain staff morale. And it's really difficult to sometimes be able to focus on the future. So as a director, one of my jobs is to think about where we're going to be in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, 15 years' time, as well as where are we going to be next week. And it's really difficult to think, where are we going to be in 5 years' time? Because 2 years ago, I wasn't thinking, oh, what? We'll all be virtual, you know. We went virtual overnight. You know, we were thinking of a plan about how to improve virtual access, and then it was done. So, yeah, so that's sometimes really difficult, is to focus on that strategy bit and think about where will we be and what will it look like.
Yeah, we didn't think we were going to be where we are now, did we?
No, definitely not.
So we started off at the beginning of this conversation talking about the press and the way in which the perception of people in the NHS is represented. So if you could give one message to the general public about the NHS just now, what would it be?
I'd say, I saw something on Twitter and I thought, oh, that's quite good. And it said along the lines of, half of the world is unable to show up at the moment because of COVID. But half of the world has. Be kind to the half that has shown up. I think for me, I mean, I would always say don't believe the media hype, as anyone would, wouldn't they? And lots of people do. But given we're one of the largest employers, the chances are you will know somebody who works in the NHS at the moment. And just be mindful and just think about it. And I'm not going to say give us a break, because actually for some things we shouldn't be given a break about, but I suppose maybe just be a bit kind, caring and compassionate, because we are there, you know, and we're still trying to do everything. None of us are deliberately not wanting to see children, young people and adults. None of us are wanting to have a 12-hour wait in the emergency department or wait 6 months for an appointment. None of us want that. You know, like I said, they're the things that they keep me awake at night worrying, because I think I wouldn't want that for my family. But the other thing is, it's a brilliant place to work, Bev. So a message to the public would be, think about it as a career. It's a fab place to work, the NHS, no matter what role you do. And Alder Hey exemplifies that. It's a true family. So, yeah.
That's brilliant. What would you wish that your colleagues across the Trust knew about you and your experience?
Oh, they'd probably say they know a lot, because I'm quite an open book. So I think they would say Lisa has shown up. I think they would say I was honest. I think they would say I'm very clear on what I want and what I expect. I do know, because my staff have said this to me a couple of times, my staff have said that they know that I am out front of them and will defend them to the hilt. But if they have done something wrong, then they know about it in terms of, but that my response is, what can we do to put it right? And they've also said that no matter what I start a conversation with, but what about the child or the young person? So what about the child, young person and family? How do we make it better for them? So that I'm very focused on that. So, yeah, I think that's the bit that they would know. I think they would say, over the last 18 months, I've been there and I've smiled. And they'd also probably say, because I had an operation at the very start of lockdown, 2 days before lockdown, and came back to work probably too soon. So they all said, I came back to work too soon after I'd had an operation in the NHS.
And last one from me is, if you could ask the Secretary of State to grant you one wish, what would you ask for?
I thought about this long, because I thought, oh, one, and it can't be for another three wishes, can it? Which is often the cheating question. My one wish and my plea to him would be, do not forget about children and young people. Invest in children and young people, because they grow up to be adults, and they grow up to be happy, healthy adults if they've been happy, healthy children. And actually, we forget about that. So don't forget about children and young people.
That's brilliant, Lisa. Thank you. Thank you so much for being part of this podcast.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
My thanks to Lisa Cooper for spending time and sharing their insights with me today. If you want to find out more about the Point of Care Foundation and our mission to humanise healthcare, you can visit us at pointofcarefoundation.org.uk or at Point of Care Foundation on Twitter. Thank you for listening to this Point of Care podcast. I hope you liked what you heard, and you'll look out for our next episode on humanising healthcare. Until then, this is me, Bedford Simons, saying goodbye.